Welcome to Forward Thinking, a podcast from Foundation Source. I'm your host, Dori Krieger. Foundation Source is the nation's largest provider of comprehensive support services for private foundations, bringing unparalleled knowledge and expertise to over 1,200 clients across the country. The best ideas in philanthropy aren't always the tried and true. Trailblazing entrepreneurs and next-generation philanthropists are transforming the sector with inspiring ideas and innovative strategies. Join us as we explore the advice, experience, and insight of some of the creative minds shaping our collective future. In this segment of Forward Thinking, we chat with a third-generation family member who has found her family's foundation to be a tool for legacy and personal discovery after the deaths of the foundation's founder and two family trustees. Mary Galletti serves as the executive director and vice chair of the Tecovas Foundation. The Tecovas Foundation funds social innovation and entrepreneurship by focusing on building community, leveraging new service models, and sustainable economic development, both domestically and internationally. Since 2009, Mary has led Tecovas to develop a concrete vision to increase the foundation's capacity and effectiveness. Mary serves as a global board member of the Global Shapers Foundation, an initiative of the World Economic Forum. She served on the board of directors of the Council on Foundations and chaired the Family Philanthropy Committee. Mary, I'm so glad to have you with me today. Thank you for taking the time to share with us kind of your philanthropic journey and how you made it your own while at the same time honoring family legacy.
Thanks, Dori. It's always fun to be with you.
What is the story of you becoming executive director of the Tecovas Foundation? How did you create space at the table?
I'm still creating space at the table. I mean, working with family is always weird, right?
And how old were you at this time?
By the time I took over the foundation in 2009, I was 27. Yeah, 27, doing the math.
And was that your first introduction to the foundation and kind of your grandmother's philanthropic legacy?
I think we'd always known that she had been philanthropic, that the family had a philanthropic legacy, but we'd never thought about it in a methodical, organized, or structured way.
I'm just recalling, I remember when you were becoming executive director and just kind of this this multi-generational conversation and kind of raising your hand saying, I'm ready to take this on and I can do this. How do you get to show what you can contribute in a leadership capacity when you still have older generation members who want to also lead? How do you make space within that leadership profile?
I mean, I had to go other places, candidly, and it's still an ongoing conversation. So I have this role and function, and yet so many of my decisions are questioned at the board level in ways that are triggering or really frustrating for me, and I don't totally understand why it happens the way it happens. My rational self can tell me that it's because my aunt and I have a loving relationship, but I am still her niece. And in some ways, I am still the 12-year-old or the 5-year-old or the 17-year-old or the 22-year-old. And she is still an authority figure. She is still an adult to me, even though in many ways we're peers now. But I will say that, even in the last couple of board meetings that I've had with the Tecovas Foundation, I'm still feeling like I have to push and create space for my own agency, for my own decision making. I think part of it is generational. Part of it is family. Part of it is human beings looking to control their own territory and their own agency. And it's messy and uncomfortable because it feels like I'm hearing that they don't trust me, and that's not what they think they're communicating. And so keeping the dialogue open and trying really, really, really hard to remember that and hold on to it when I'm feeling particularly triggered is a challenge, but it's the thing that I am working on at the moment.
It just is complex, and you're certainly navigating it as well as anyone could. When you connect with other members of the next generation, and these are folks who have, like you, who have tremendous accomplishments by the time they're in their early 30s, what advice do you have for them in kind of navigating the Family Foundation leadership space?
There's a lot of language between, if we say millennials and boomers, but even, you know, millennials and Gen Xers and baby boomers, there's a lot of language that millennials will use in particular that sounds like, get out of the way, it's my turn now. And I think that's a mistake. I think one of the greatest gifts of being involved in the family philanthropy space is the number of people, of executive directors, of foundation leaders, of trustees who have become mentors and colleagues and friends who have talked me through how to navigate really difficult board meetings or really difficult conversations. And maybe some of them should have retired or should be retiring sooner than they are, but that's not my decision to make for them. And if I hadn't spent the time building the relationship with them, I think I'd be much worse at my job.
It's not about necessarily intergenerational transfer of leadership, but it's about making space for multi-generational leadership at the same time.
I think that's right. I think it is about multi-generational leadership. And by the way, we millennials are going to be very irritated when 10 years from now, when we're in our 40s and early 50s and late 30s, when the whatever is coming behind us, Gen Z, is suddenly telling us to get out of the way. So I think if we don't figure out this multi-generational approach pretty quickly, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Tell us a little bit about your foundation, its origin and original mission.
So an important piece of context, the family got its wealth through a patent for barbed wire back in the 1870s. And you know, very, very long story short, my great-grandfather ended up being sent down to Amarillo, Texas, to buy up as much land as he could, because in the 1870s, the United States was in the Great Westward Migration, right? So he bought up a whole bunch of land and fenced it off and made it a ranch. And our family still is there today, which we're very proud of. But it means that we had sort of two family headquarters, one in Cleveland, Ohio, and one in Amarillo, Texas, which for those who don't have the map of the United States right in front of them at this moment is the 4-hour mark between Oklahoma City and Albuquerque off Old 66. So my grandmother, when she was 89 in 1998, wanted to do one last major philanthropic project. And she thought that the biggest gap in Amarillo was actually in arts education. There was a very vibrant arts community there, but there was no adequate place for any of those groups to perform. It actually has its own ballet, its own opera, its own orchestra. And they were basically playing in school auditoriums, which, while great, doesn't fully capture the robustness of the art being created. And arts education in Texas at the time was being cut fairly significantly. And so she wanted to do one major arts investment, because she honestly believed that if young people didn't have access to creative thinking and creative learning, then all of the STEM type research, all of the STEM education in the world wouldn't make them adequately prepared for leadership, for management, for life. So she basically led the charge to build this performing arts center. It is, up until just very recently, it was the most acoustically perfect building in the world. We're very proud of that. And it was completed in 2004. Unfortunately, my grandmother didn't live to see its completion. What was supposed to happen after that was the foundation was going to have a fairly small amount of money left over, about $500,000 or $600,000, for the grandchildren to learn about being involved in their communities, right? So that would mean, you know, maybe $20,000 a year in grant making, enough to make small investments in organizations and sort of see what happened. Unfortunately, two of my grandmother's three daughters, my mother and my aunt, passed away in 2004 fairly unexpectedly. And so a couple of things happened. First, the family had to totally reorient itself around its business. Second, because of the way the estates were planned, the foundation went from being about $500,000 to about $14 million almost overnight, which requires a whole different kind of management than a small $500,000 sort of dining room table experience. Thankfully, because of the Performing Arts Center, we had a fair number of carry-forward credits. So we didn't have to immediately start doing $700,000 in grant-making a year. We had a little time to figure out and have conversation and explore. But once we realized that we were going to have to do some really significant grant making, our brains kind of exploded a little bit.
I'm interested in the name of your foundation, the Tecovas Foundation. Is there any special meaning behind that?
There is, actually. My grandmother was really worried about the foundation changing my cousins and my lives in either positive or negative ways. So she didn't want the family name to be involved. On the one hand, she didn't want to make it easier for us to get into college. On the other hand, she wanted to give us some mechanism by which we could determine whether someone actually knew her as well as they'd say. I mean, invariably, and this still happens even, you know, a decade or more later, people will come up to me and say, oh, I was such a good friend of your grandmother. I was such a good friend of your parents. Now tell me more about the Tecovas Foundation. And I know immediately that they don't actually know anything,
right?
Or weren't as close as they believed themselves to be. The foundation name is actually, it's named for a spring on the ranch. So there's the Tecovas Spring, which sort of runs in the back near a couple of ravines. And I don't know why she chose that. I suspect because it ends up creating a little bit of a natural oasis in what is otherwise a prairie.
So you're 22 years old. You're now, you know, thrust with this foundation. You're also dealing with a lot of family loss. What I'm interested in, too, though, is this notion that philanthropy was always a part of your family story. And you talk about the family business. So there's a family enterprise that you all have been working together around. When you were a teenager, how do you think your parents prepared you for a role in this family enterprise, which included the foundation?
We had, you know, as I said, we had these annual meetings where we would get together and talk about what was happening in terms of the land, how the ranch was doing, what that meant. We had some drought conditions. How do we manage for drought conditions? How do we treat our farmers who are on our land? How do we think about the cowboys? We actually still have cowboys working the ranch. How do we make sure that they're well cared for? How do we make sure the cattle are well cared for?
Even when you were a teenager?
Even when I was a teenager, which I think helped build a, I don't even want to say empathy. I don't think that's right, though that's a part of it, but it helped us understand that the ranch wasn't just naturally an ecosystem, but that our family success was predicated on an ecosystem, and our contribution helped us reap benefit. Similarly, when I turned about 16 or 17, I think this is true for my cousins as well, we were given a meeting about once or twice a year with our family office managers, where no adults were in the room except for our family office manager. And we were allowed to ask whatever question we wanted to ask, however impolite, however potentially uncomfortable. So if I wanted to understand how much I was going to inherit at what age, I could talk about it. I could ask about it. I could ask why we were invested in what we were invested in and why I might want to change that or not. And I think a lot of those conversations are fairly taboo for a lot of families. They don't want to talk about the money. They don't want their children to have a relationship to the money that's impairing to them. For me anyway, and for our family, having the space to talk about it, having the space to engage on it and be able to ask those questions and feel comfortable with that information actually helped me not feel that kind of negative relationship to it. It just feels like a thing that I now understand and know about. It didn't feel taboo. It doesn't feel dirty. I don't feel as guilty about it.
Mm-hmm. Let's fast forward to your early 20s, where now there's the Tecovas Foundation. You know, I've heard you say a couple times, succession happens. It just happens. And so now you're with the second generation, and then a lot of the third generation. So I've heard you talk about, too, about this multi-generational conversation or working together rather than an intergenerational transfer of leadership. Love to hear a little bit more about how you guys or how you personally navigated that.
I think we're still going through the generational transition. I think we're still navigating those conversations. You know, when we engaged the foundation in a real way after the succession, the majority of the board was under 25. Now it's right about at 30. My aunt and my stepdad are in their 70s and 80s, respectively. But one of the very wise things that my aunt suggested to us, though we didn't believe her at the time, if I'm totally honest, one of the things that she suggested to us was that we didn't actually know what we were really interested in. At 23, 24, 25, 26, we were still discovering our passions. We were still discovering the things that moved us, the injustices that we hated the most or wanted to solve the most. We're still doing that, which is part of why we fund the way we fund. We don't fund any particular issue area because we couldn't possibly even agree on domestic versus international, let alone health, women and girls, education, any of those kinds of questions. So instead, it's just this constant conversation about, is this an organization working on an issue in a new and interesting way that we want to give some space to, that we want to see what they can do? I remember finding a particular grantee doing permaculture work, which is an agricultural process, and being so excited to share it with my aunt, and my aunt coming back and telling me a story about how we, the family, had been working on that since the 60s, and I didn't know, right? And so I had this new relationship or this new connection with my aunt on this idea that I was really excited about that I thought was all new and novel and was, in fact, well, quite ancient, but also a part of our family for half a century already.
And how many of your cousins are you working with on the foundation? How many third-generation members are there?
So at the moment, there's only three third-generation members. Okay. There will be four at some point. Though I think, you know, as we get into the places where we're getting married and having children, folks will step forward or step back as their time or calendar kind of allows. So at the moment, we're a relatively small board, but we're a fairly small family as well.
So that's a really busy time in someone's life, late 20s, early 30s, establishing careers, establishing families. And if I remember correctly, you all are geographically dispersed, too. I know you live in Washington, D.C., but you're based out of Ohio and Texas, or as I've heard you say, wherever your laptop is. So how has your family foundation helped you stay connected with these family members who are all over the place, geographically speaking?
So I think there's a couple of things that are true at the same time. The family business also keeps us really connected. But the foundation and the family business actually have to work together. And one of the more interesting parts about the foundation is it's given us space, particularly my cousins and I, a chance to figure out how we work well together in a non-crisis, fairly low-stress context, so that when we hit moments of crisis or stress in the business, we have a greater degree of trust. We have a greater degree of ability to listen to each other, to hear each other, to brainstorm productively. I mean, for the first few years when we were running the foundation, or when I was running the foundation, there were some really, really, really challenging family conversations. And we all love each other. We like each other a lot. We want to spend time together. We're not one of those families that you have to pull teeth to get them in the room together. But really, really hard conversations. In the last couple of years, we've had some very challenging conversations on the business side, and I think they've honestly worked better because we've figured out how to work together on the context of the foundation. It's also an opportunity, candidly, to connect with each other over things we're passionate about, over ideas we're passionate about that have nothing to do with sort of profit and loss statements. So I have a cousin who's still really, really interested in interactive art. He is a producer of Figment in New York. He goes to Burning Man every year. And so the way he sees the world and wants to engage in the world is absolutely different from my other cousin who's really into agricultural stuff, and from me who's very much into community building and relationship building. So it's given us a chance to sort of demonstrate our strengths together and get to celebrate those as a family. And that's been one of the biggest gifts of the work, honestly.
It's been a while since you were 20, a little bit of time since you were 22.
And I'm an old lady, that's what you say.
No.
It's true.
I can't say that at all. But if you could go back and visit with your 20-something self, what would you say to yourself right now? You've had a lot of varied experiences since that time, a lot of learning with family, with, you know, organized philanthropy, with, as you said, you know, the smaller funder community too. There's a lot that's happened in that amount of time. What would you say to your 20-something self?
Chill out. No, seriously. I mean, and I probably, you know, if, when we're back 10 years from now having this conversation again.
I hope we are.
Slightly differently. And you asked me what I would say to my 32-year-old self. I'd probably say the same thing. There's so much fun to be had. There's so much learning. And I'm a person who sweats the small stuff and sweats the details and sweats every interaction, every comment. I take it personally. I worry that I've just offended somebody. We're going to leave this interview and I'm going to be panicked that it was awful for at least 3 days. And honestly, the adventure itself has been so incredible. The friends I've made, the colleagues, the learning, the experiences, I wouldn't trade them for anything. And if I, at 22, knew that and stopped worrying about, you know, were all the bullet points on my resume absolutely perfect? Should I raise my hand and speak at this session? Should I suggest myself as a speaker? Should I put myself, if I stopped sweating that and just kind of said, well, give it a go, I think I'd have gotten here with much fewer gray hair, which I do have at 32. I discovered this and I'm very upset about it.
As we think about this multi-generational conversation, it seems important to understand how each generation approaches their life or approaches their philanthropic giving. So I'm interested in how you see that, kind of this integration. I've heard a lot about millennials, this integration of all these different worlds of professional, of kind of your volunteer life, of your personal life. Tell us a little bit more about how that's played out for you and what you see happening.
So if you sort of think of your life, or I think of my life in four buckets, as you outlined, right, that my personal life, so my friendships and my marriage and my family, my professional life, which I guess splits into the foundation, but also whatever other affiliations, my volunteer life and my, I guess you could say your my spiritual life, whatever that means to an individual. Those things for me are far more integrated. And I think generationally, for a lot of millennials, they're far more integrated. I want my professional life to have some element of my volunteer life in it, fully integrated. I want my life to have purpose. And if I'm going to spend so much time at work, I want that to benefit the world. And that has some spiritual component in and of itself. And because I work for and with my family, it's all one mesh. The benefit of all of that is when it's great, it is so great, right? I feel whole and fully present and fully seen and authentic in all my interactions. But when one of those things goes bad or is struggling for whatever reason, I have a bad board meeting, I have a not very good interaction with a grantee, I get in a fight with a friend or a fight with a cousin, it all feels messy. It all feels not good. And so I can't sort of put more energy into work because that will help me stay distracted while I heal from what other wound I'm healing from. It's all there. And I don't know if that's entirely a good thing or entirely a bad thing, but I like it a lot. It suits me. I think it's been hard in an intergenerational way because I know my grandmother didn't live her life that way and my aunt generally doesn't live her life that way. Older folks live their lives that way. I think they have buckets. And so understanding the...
I just think it's an interesting point to make, particularly around all these generations working together. And as you said, Generation Z is coming up. So what are we going to have, like 4 or 5 generations at once trying to find common ground and work together? So I think it's important to see where we're all coming from and how we're approaching things differently. And yet there's a thread of similarity there. And how can we create common bond around that?
I mean, what I'll say about that is, so there was this very interesting conversation that I had with my aunt. We were in the middle of a fight. It was a loving fight, but it was a fight all the same. And I suggested that she didn't care about hunger the way I cared about hunger. Which, if I'm honest, I probably knew was patently false, but we were fighting. So there you have it. And she said back in retaliation, I think we care about it the same. I just think we see the solutions as different. And I was very irritated by that response because I suspected it was right. There's something about multi-generational, intergenerational, diverse groups, whatever diversity means, right? Diversity can mean age, gender, political affiliation, experience, anything. Diverse groups are stronger because a multitude of perspectives means a multitude of problem solving.
The diversity of perspectives helps us all come to a good, better solution. Like, one generation doesn't have the end-all, be-all answer, but by working together, maybe we can figure something out.
I think so.
So if we come full circle, how do you think about the Tecovas Foundation as a tool for you for personal discovery over the past decade or so, and as a tool for preserving family legacy?
So amongst other roles in the family, I also end up playing the role of family archivist. My grandparents, my great-grandparents, and earlier did a really good job of keeping lots of letters and diaries and photos and telegrams and all kinds of fascinating things, most of which are filled with fairly banal, everyday whatnot, but some of which are really interesting. And the thing that surprised me the most, I, for a very long time, believed that I was unique in the context of my family. I'm interested in things that no one else is interested in. And when I go back and read those letters, when I go back and read those diaries, I have a great aunt or great great aunt from the 1890s who wrote a letter to her sister about a project she was working on. There were some folks doing some labor organizing and she was funding them. And she was very proud of this and she was keeping it from her father, who would have been mortified to have found out. And she was writing to her sister because she was excited that it was working. And I realized I am very much a product of my family, even mm-hmm. if I never would have guessed. And so the foundation just feels like yet another thing that is a tool for us to explore the things that make us us. And the disagreement, it turns out, is also a part of that story. And that the adventure will continue on. You know, when I hopefully have children, when my nieces and nephews grow up, I hope that they believe that they are profoundly unique in the context of the family, and then celebrate and rejoice in discovering that indeed they're not, that they are unique, but they're also very much a product of us.
Thank you. That's lovely. No, that's just, you said it so beautifully though, Mary. Really, that was great. Thank you. Thanks for being here for the conversation. Thanks for being so open and candid. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure everyone listening does too.
Thanks, Dory. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
To learn more about this segment of Forward Thinking and our work at Foundation Source, please visit our resources page at foundationsource.com. While you're there, tell us what you thought of this segment and who you'd like to hear on a future one. We'd love to hear from you. Our podcast is produced by Gabrielle Galanek. I'm your host, Dory Krieger.